I'm Cisco from Silke's Gravity Laboratory, and I'm going to be telling you about different ways of probing the vacuum with continuous under-air detectors. So just as some preliminary comments, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what kind of vacuum I mean, because these are going to be experimental proposals. Then I'm going to tell you just a few small things about the under effect and how we're trying to measure it in these systems. After which I'm going to move on to a different way of probing the vacuum, the so-called entanglement harvesting protocol, and how we can implement it in these same systems using continuous under detectors. After which I'll just talk a little bit about where we're going from here and what's next in these experiments. So the vacuum that we care about and that we're trying to realize experimentally for these types of probes is going to be played by our good friend, a pancake PEC. Has a familiar Lagrangian to a lot of people. In this representation, there's a two-dimensional PEC field. It's living in the XY plane. There are a couple of times where I'm going to talk about a 3+1 version of this and how it relates to the probes that we're using with it. But I'm going to go back and forth between the 2+1 and the 3+1 description. So the probe that we're going to be using to extract things, information, and interact with our vacuum is described by a simple laser field traveling in the z direction. It has the free Lagrangian, looks like this familiar form, and it has vector potential with a component in the x direction, and it travels along z, and interacts with the BC such that basically the squares of these things for the BC field, because it's a complex field, you get a magnitude squared, and for this laser, you're just going to get the time derivative of the vector potential component that we have for the laser. And so this is just basically E squared times the density in the BEC. And what this does to the laser is alters the equation of motion of just simple propagation through the material. And for constant BEC fields, you just get an effective lowering of the speed of light through the material, and it's just an index of refraction effect. At the next order, we get BEC fluctuations getting transferred to this laser, and those are going to have the information that we care about for both the under effect and for this entanglement harvesting implementation. So apologies to Bill, but I am going to show this comic until I find out who is in this ice cube. So I've been polling audiences. If anyone knows who this scientist is, who's freezing there at a static position in a vacuum at t equals zero, please point it out to me, because I've been trying to figure it out. Ultimately, though, the vacuum appears hot to accelerated observers, and we're going to try and see evidence of this in these BEC proposals, and later in the week, Cameron's going to give a talk about a helium implementation of this same idea. So this initial idea came from Jorg at a meeting that we had in Nottingham. He suggested we could use lasers in this way as under detectors. At a meeting where we were all coming together to try and brainstorm different ways of observing the under effect in various different systems. And this idea, a couple of years later, led to our PRL about it, where basically the idea is to set an initial beam coming in that has a frequency peaked at omega L, just a largely monochromatic laser, and then throw it into a modulator that has a modulation frequency that's significantly lower than the laser frequency, so something like in the megahertz, or possibly slightly higher. And it'll create these two sidebands. After filtering out the center, these sidebands travel along the laser path, are deflected by a rotating optical apparatus that puts a point of interaction between the laser and the BEC along a circular trajectory. And in doing so, sample fluctuations in the BEC density along that accelerated path. After which, it's just a red out in the photodiode. Now, these peaks are chosen very carefully, so the atomic resonance at the center is balanced on both sides by these modulation sidebands in such a way to cancel the stark potentials on the BEC and make sure we don't destroy it while we're trying to probe it. So just a little bit about what this setup actually does when we try to measure it or try and extract signals from it. The beautiful thing about it is that we don't need any spatial interferometry to extract a signal from this. Ordinarily, we would have phase fluctuations that, for instance, carry our signal, and we would want to do some sort of interferometry spatially that would convert those phase fluctuations to amplitude fluctuations so we can observe them in our photodetectors. The nice thing about these modulated systems is that we can get them to interfere in frequency space and remove the need for extra spatial interferometry that might add noise and all sorts of other complications that we're trying to eliminate. The relevant modes are built from both common mode and difference modes. These things, there's a difference mode. So the notation just means this is the upper sideband and this is the lower sideband, and they're composed of a bunch of frequency elements that ultimately will carry different under detector gaps along with them, all in one shot. From these operators, you can build correlated to photon modes, and these are the two relevant ones for the analysis. One is just a rotated spectral quadrature that comes from this difference mode signal, and the reason why we care about the difference mode is because the phase shifts for each of these two modulation bands are opposite, and therefore, the difference between the signals for those is carrying our signal, but the sum cancels the phase shift out that we're trying to characterize and probe. So another beautiful thing about this is that most of the excess noise from the laser is common mode. So by looking and extracting only these difference mode signals, we can reduce noise that gets channeled into those common modes. And these have a nice familiar commutation relation. They're just like X and P operators, but with slightly more structure because they're not Hermitian and whatnot. Now, I'm going to run just very quickly about the notation because it's going to matter for the rest of it, but ultimately some of these details aren't going to be crucial to get the point, so don't worry too much if I'm glossing over a couple of the details. So we have these two oppositely detuned sidebands, and we're going to represent their annihilation operators as just a coherent classical part and some quantum fluctuations around that. And I'm going to factor out these peak laser frequencies that come from the laser frequency plus and minus the modulation frequency. And so these are just the omega plus and minuses. And again, I'm going to be working the limit where the modulation frequency is much less than the laser frequency. You can put these together. The combined modes have a similar structure. You have a coherent part that oscillates at this modulation frequency, and you have quantum fluctuations that are built from things that are modulated at that same frequency, but contain fluctuations from each of those sidebands. And the reason why I care to show you this description is because the laser interaction with the BEC inserts these fluctuations, and here phi r is basically a density fluctuation coming from the BEC, inserts these fluctuations into the phase, and you get an effective shift of the quantum fluctuations around those sidebands that relates to those density fluctuations. And by measuring the correlations coming out of the laser, we can find correlations that are transduced from the BEC into the laser field, and pull out information about the acceleration along that trajectory and how it pertains to the Unruh effect. So there are two methods that we've been exploring to analyze this and to understand it. The first one was based on a Bogoliubov transformation method that Bill came up with. And it basically takes pieces of these difference mode spectrals operators from both sides of these various different sidebands. And if you enforce unitarity and seed it with the fact that you know, or that you're assuming the fluctuations from the BEC go into the laser phase, then you get this set of transformations where X and Y are from the laser and D are the mode operators from the BEC. So what you see immediately is that a bunch of noise from the electromagnetic field gets dumped into the BEC through the interaction, but it doesn't amplify or de-amplify the modes in the BEC, so it doesn't damp or become unstable. There's a bunch of interesting stuff happening with the rest of the Bogoliubov transformation, but Bill has talked about it a bunch over the years, and I'm not going to focus on that for this. The fluctuations in the photon flux have pieces coming from the common mode and the difference mode signals. The thing immediately that you see from this, if you do the analysis with those Bogoliubov transformations, you find that the piece that carries signal from the BEC is this basically momentum associated with the difference mode operator. And unfortunately, if we want to reduce that operator that gets dumped into the BEC, by squeezing that part of the incident electromagnetic field, it comes at the expense, because of the uncertainty principle, of adding noise to the signal carrying field, or the signal carrying operator. This is a problem that is not confronted by LIGO, and it requires a little bit of extra balancing, because we don't want to just minimize the noise that's getting dumped into the BEC, because that cranks up the noise on the signal carrying operator. So we have to find a balancing point between that. The concept of added noise helps with that, but these are ongoing analyses. So you can ask, well, what is the power spectrum associated with the photon flux that comes out of this? If I assume that that Bogoliubov transformation is telling me how the BEC and laser interaction is dumping a signal into my field. Just a quick analysis shows that you get a regular shot noise term, you get some back action, and then you get the piece that carries the signal. The detector response function for an accelerated observer sits in this power spectrum in the last part of this, and those Bogoliubov transformations imply that you get this detector response function sitting with a bunch of coefficients in front of it coming from how the modes are interacting with each other. Now the problem comes up with this is that you get these complex coefficients, and it's unclear exactly how they can be reconciled with pulling out real signals and with the symmetries that we know that our photocurrents should have. So that's an indication that there's something we don't know about that. We're exploring it right now, and one of the methods we're using to explore it is just a time-dependent perturbation theory method. And it is a little bit more modest in its familiarity with everyone and its complexity, but it's a good way to have a firm and rigorous way to check what we're doing is correct or not. So we will just back up and use a more exact version of the interaction Hamiltonian. The full one looks like this, where again, this is the vector potential, that's the and now 2 plus 1 BEC field. And if you just do some perturbations on these, the relevant interaction that comes out of this one just looks like some terms coming from the BEC perturbations and some from the electric field perturbations. And the nice thing about this is that I can do perturbation theory on this. I can write down my Dyson series and average over the time scale set by the laser frequency. Get something that is very tangible out of it that we can check the other calculations with. A thing to keep in mind when looking at this, because it doesn't have as familiar of a phase interaction form, but there's a difference between the operator that appears in here and, for instance, the operator combinations, even at the linear level, that appear in the photon flux operator. And the difference between these two things makes the signal processing actually interesting. And quite difficult. But we're very close to being able to actually get some answers from the analysis. So hopefully Yorma and Cameron, Bill, Silke, and I can figure something out before too long. And then we just use the Dyson series, pull out everything that we need. I'm just going to, before moving on, say a couple of words about photon counting. The simplest thing you could do to understand what's happening in your photodetector data is, okay, well, I have this Glauber's P1, not the P functions, a different P1. Basically, we know that the probability of single photon absorption has this simple form, and we also know that the probability of delayed coincidence to photon absorption has this, or detection rather, has this simple form. So these are basically just normal ordered photon flux operators, 1 power and 2 powers for unequal times. The annoying thing is, if you do the perturbation theory, you find that what comes out that depends on the Whiteman function, or correlations in this BEC density along the accelerated trajectory, is only the real part. Unfortunately, this is a purely imaginary quantity. So the real part is not really what we were looking for. Ways around this are possibly do some extra interferometry, or possibly go to a higher order and see other combinations. It gets very messy very quickly, but we're seeing what we can still pull from that. Now that that's out of the way, I'm going to talk about the next idea, and it's a way of stealing entanglement from the vacuum, and again, the same pancake vacuum from before. And because I'm in Nottingham, I throw in as many Robin Hood references as I possibly can. Long live the king. So the way that we do this entanglement stealing from the vacuum is by, in its purest form, in the RQI community, they use these original under DeWitt detectors. They're two levels. We take a pair of them, shoot them into a vacuum, and try and extract from their excitation correlations that would be possible to demonstrate entanglement with. So ordinarily, our unordered detectors, we don't expect them to click in a vacuum if we're not accelerating. However, if we only interact for a very short amount of time, the time dependence of that interaction induces clicks in our detector. And so the longer we do it, the less probability on average, I will get effective clicking. But if I do a whole bunch of runs for short periods of time, I'll get a bunch of clicks. And if I do it in the right way, I can extract a signal of entanglement from that. And so the model, in a slightly generalized form from what Bill had, this one has a time and space smearing given by this chi and f factors. This phi is the 2 plus 1 field that we're trying to probe. In this case, you could think of it still in the 2 plus 1 space time. Yeah, and this m is just the detector monopole moment. In the interaction picture, this operator just has a simple form where this capital omega is the detector gap. So we have two level detectors. Their gap is omega. We want to use them to show that their excitation is an indicator of entanglement, and that we've gotten that entanglement from the vacuum itself. The thing that we use to quantify this entanglement is called the negativity. It's a fairly reasonable and simple quantifier for entanglement. It's a little bit more useful because of its convenience rather than its conceptual aesthetic, but it is something that you can calculate, and it's used to characterize these types of entanglement harvesting scenarios. The expression for it is a little complicated, but basically it's an interplay between two things: vacuum excitation caused by our switching on of these detectors, switching on and off, and the non-local effect of virtual particle exchange between the detectors. So it's the balancing between these two that allows us to harvest entanglement, because this negativity, if it's non-zero, we get entanglement, or it's necessary and sufficient in these simple systems, just of two qubits, to show that your system is inseparable and therefore entangled in this system. The details of this quantity don't matter terribly much, but they're expressible in terms of k space integrals, and you can analyze exactly what the effects of smearing and also dispersion have on these systems, because in all real analog gravity experiments, we have dispersion, and we're not exactly in this linearly dispersive Klein-Gordon regime. So the analysis of something like that negativity from this simple pair of two-level detectors tells us that the strange position we need to be in the parameter space is that the product of this gap and basically the amount of I think I missed the last indicator. But it tells us that what we need to do to entangle these detectors effectively is be in this regime where the product of the gap and the time that we interact is much less than a cycle. This is very unfamiliar if you're thinking of trying to extract spectral information from a system. You usually think that I need many cycles, or at least a couple cycles of this mode to extract that spectral mode information. But in this case, we don't care about the spectral mode information. We just care about maximizing entanglement. And so for that purpose, this is the parameter regime that we care to be in, even if it's rather unfamiliar or unintuitive. And so, again, the maximal harvest occurs when the time scale is inverse, roughly one over the detector gap. And that should make York happy, because he was saying that we need to be very careful about keeping our time scales much shorter than the coherence time of the modes. Well, if I'm in a subcycle region, I'm definitely not letting phonons bounce back and forth in my system, and I should have a good relativistic character to that analogy, and it should be behaving in just the nice field theory way that I think it should be. York, sorry, I understand I'm kind of poking. We can talk about that later if you actually agree with that. Another thing that's important about this is that the detectors couple only the density as a function of time, throughout time, and not to its conjugate momentum. This is important because there are a number of ways to actually demonstrate entanglement in these systems. If I'm trying to characterize the whole entanglement structure of the field, I'm going to use different methods than just a single localized detector. For us, we care about the time evolution and the correlations in time that are induced by this interaction. We don't care about mapping the whole thing, like, for instance, if I want to destroy the whole BEC, map the whole thing out, and measure two commuting variables like phi and pi at a fixed time, I can get complementary information. This is relates a little bit to what York mentioned about the connection between unequal time correlations and equal time correlations, and how you can equivalently extract entanglement information in both of those ways. So can we implement these using continuous under detectors? The short answer is yes. The negativity is a bit unsuited for actually serving as our entanglement measure in these systems. A more operationally accessible quantity is called the inseparability. And it's basically built out of these joint operators for the two detectors. And it follows basically from the DGCZ condition. What this is conceptually is the sum of the variances of either the sum of the amplitude of the difference between these two detectors or the difference of the phases between these two. These quantities, if the system is inseparable, this sum of variances will dip below one. So if we measure these variances coming out of these two beams, show that it dips below one, we've shown that we've made the two detectors be in an inseparable state, which shows that they're entangled. And the way of constructing these variables to throw into that inseparability condition is just like in the under detector case, like in that project. We take these common mode and difference mode signals, but for each of the beams, and then form those Q and P variables that were in the inseparability condition from those rotated operators. And then we get something that, with a finite integration time, looks very familiar, because we know how to calculate these operators, and we know how to take their variances and extract them from the photocurrent data, And so we can directly throw them in and see if we can show entanglement from them. I'm very close. So just a couple comments about how that works. An arbitrary non-Hermitian operator has a variance that's given by this expression where I'm in the interaction picture, I have a reduced density matrix for the two detectors, and I compute the variances in the reduced subspace in this way. When I do that and throw them in the inseparability condition, I find that the only thing that I really need to show is that the difference in these phase operators for that I could extract from the two beams coming into the photodetectors has to be less than a half, the variance of them. So if I show that, then I've shown that the inseparability condition is satisfied and that my system is entangled and that I've entangled them by stealing it from the vacuum. I'm going to just gloss through these details, but if you are interested, I can talk about them privately. Just do a simple perturbation theory in the interaction picture approach. We have a reduced density operator defined like so. We have these linear and quadratic corrections to the state induced by that interaction. And we have an interaction Hamiltonian that's just built of this same exact thing from the previous analysis, but two copies of it. And then you have pieces of Whiteman's functions from them. They're much simpler than the accelerated ones. But ultimately, the structure that you get in these continuous systems parallels the two-level detector framework completely. You, in the subspace for the two detectors afterwards, you get a sum of projectors for no clicks, one detector clicks, and two detector clicks. When you throw this framework into what you've already calculated, you find that you get the same type of reduced density matrix as the two-level systems in the regular entanglement harvesting protocol. And for k equals k prime, both of the clicks have the same wave vector. And you can parallel the same analysis as the two-level ones. The extra integrations over k cause a little bit of extra problems, but the structure is the same. So that's where we're at with the analysis. We are at the point of being very close to submit the, I hope Rob's not going to object to that. We're close to submitting the paper. All of these elements provide a good indication that we actually can steal entanglement from the vacuum in this way. Just a couple of comments about where we're going from here. It's kind of difficult to achieve under temperatures that are on the same order as the ambient temperature in these systems. Do we use a thermal initial state to be more accurate? What happens when we do that? Can we use superfluid helium for this? Cameron's going to talk on Friday about that. The signal extraction ambiguities I mentioned, they've been a topic of discussion in our group for a long time. We're getting around it with a perturbation theory analysis. Is it going to tell us that we need more interferometry? I don't know. We're still trying to find that out. For the harvesting description, we need a little bit more accurately to include thermal noise. And I have some methods to do this that I learned about in Banaska last week, thankfully. And hopefully we can get those in to be really sure that we have a robust phenomenon. Another thing is that our operators have a bunch of under DeWitt detector gaps in them. The original analysis only has one. Exactly how we can deal with that, do we need to isolate one with a state preparation? I'm not sure. Those are topics of future discussion and research. And so with that, I'll thank you for listening.
Thanks, Cisco. You asked me for 15 minutes warning. That was 15, not 5.
I thought I missed it because I saw this and I thought... Okay, I may have gone a little under then.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Well, now I feel guilty, but you did ask me for a 15-minute warning.
Yeah, I thought I missed it, and you were saying, now you have 6.
Okay, questions. I'm just going to go first, middle there, and then...
Also, at risk of annoying the collaborators that I want to acknowledge and thank, I just threw up a picture from last night. Apologies if it is not as professional as you might have hoped.
yes. So, me, right? Okay, yeah. So thank you for the talk. I think I have one comment and one question.
Sure.
So I suppose, I mean, you're trying to extract entanglement from quantum field itself. So maybe some, you know, if you publish paper, Lefferi might say that how can you tell that this is from quantum field, the entanglement from quantum field, because it is known that, you know, if you decompose a Weinmann function into the commutator and anti-commutator, in free field theory, the commutator part does not depend on the field, the state of the field. So in that sense, even if the field is not entangled, you can steal entanglement from the commutator. So if you have detectors very close to each other, which was, you know, in your...
So the detectors, just to address it, the detectors are kept at space-like separation with respect to the sound cone structure in the mm-hmm. BUC. So there's no communication between them during the...
Maybe that's the case, right? So, yeah, my comment will be, you know, probably you should make sure that communication is not, affecting your...
Yes, incorporated by construction.
Okay. And my question will be so is this... Are you using detector in circular motion for entanglement harvesting?
No.
Okay, so no. It's like at rest.
Yeah, because, I mean, we don't want clicks from acceleration for that purpose.
Okay.
I think you could, in some ways, possibly enhance or de-enhance with acceleration. There's a bunch of work on this. Rob would probably know better than I do about that. We're trying just to do the simplest version right now.
Okay. Yeah, typically it's like, if you have like acceleration and, you know, you induce Unruh effect, then high temperature will try to kill the correlation between detectors. So, yeah.
I think sometimes you can arrange it so that you increase it, but I'm not an expert on that.
Yeah. So. All right, thank you very much.
Go next, Sergey, because we've got plenty of time.
Probably have a naive question. So like in the Unruh effect, we have excitation of detector. So in your setup with laser beam, is it a kind of transfer of quanta from lower sideband to the upper sideband, or it would be too naive to think this way?
No, so each sideband has a copy of the signal.
Okay.
And the different sideband extracts that signal while reducing the noise.
But what is it? I mean, what is excited?
Ultimately, the photon field of the laser gets excited.
In every sideband, you say. In each sideband.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Independently, but because we've engineered it in a certain layer, the architecture, we haven't built this fully yet. But it's constructed so that. The relationship between them, it makes it easy to pull it out and actually even possible. Otherwise, it would be a lot trickier.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And it would destroy the BEC in the process, which we're trying not to do.
Okay. Hi, I think I'm missing the bigger picture a little bit. So a BEC, you're treating that as your vacuum.
Yeah.
And are you talking about a BEC with interactions between the atoms?
There's
yes,
like then. The self-interaction okay. part, but we're trying to work in a linearized regime where we get an effective Klein-Gordon field for this.
BEC. So, because the BEC state is actually a squeezed vacuum. If your G2D appears in there, you have entanglement in a BEC. I'm not sure. That's due to nonlinearity. I'm not sure. Is that the entanglement you're extracting, or are you talking about something else entirely?
That is something else. And honestly, we're trying to avoid that getting involved just because it kind of muddies the waters. So we're trying to stay in the regime where we can just think of this field as a free Klein-Gordon field in its ground state or in its vacuum state. That's really the regime that. Is more closely related to the entanglement harvesting protocol. And we're just seeing if we can ultimately implement that protocol as is. Or if we can't,
but what, you have an extra tuning knob here. You can really extract even more entanglement because it's there in your vacuum, as it were, in your two-mode squeeze state. So yeah. I would take use of that. And
I don't know how any of those knobs work ultimately as a theorist, but yes, I have been told that this is possible, and perhaps if and when the experiment's actually carried out, we could play with these.
And it's not accelerating, just to be clear.
Yeah. For the harvest, it's not accelerating. But, you know, one step at a time.
Any more questions? Yeah, I thought you might have one.
So, I mean, comment on there. So, in that sense, you know, for if you write down this as a scalar field theory, you ignore things like, you know, vacuum depletion and quantum depletion and things like that, which would come in there in the end. But that's all, for the moment, it's all ignored. Yeah. So it has to be weakly, really weakly interacting gas, so that it's a nearly ideal zero temperature.
Maybe I can also comment on this? I mean, the quantum fluctuations in the BEC, which look like Klein-Gordon in the long wavelength limit, this is precisely the quantum depletion. This is precisely from that the condensate wants to squeeze out some atoms from the K equals zero mode. So I think that is what you want to measure at T equals zero. If you wouldn't have the interaction, you wouldn't have any sound velocity, you wouldn't have the entanglement you are looking for.
Hold on. Could you elaborate on this a little bit?
The interaction in the BEC is what gives you the speed of sound. And the speed of sound is what gives you the entanglement, which gives you that it looks like a Klein-Gordon.
Okay, yes.
And that's what you want to measure.
Okay. Your point is that if I'm in a regime where it looks like a Klein-Gordon field in its vacuum state, the squeezing is there already.
Yes.
Okay. Is this inequivalent to the correlation structure that's just in a regular vacuum scalar field? Because I was told that in this regime where it behaves like a scalar field in its vacuum state, I could just take that as a starting point and say, okay, if that's the case, what can I do with that vacuum field?
No, you can do that, but the entanglement you get from this scalar field description is, if you go back to the atomic description, comes precisely from this quantum depletion. I mean, it's like this, if you want to take the Klein-Gordon equation, and you want to produce particles.
Yes.
How that happens if you switch off the interaction, you have initially, you have quantum depletion, then switch off the interaction, and in these quantum depletion particles are now real excitations. I mean, this is, in a sense, I would say, the quantum depletion is precisely what you want to measure here.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the entanglement in that effective vacuum state, this is an effective description, right? It's an emergent macroscopic structure. It comes from somewhere, and you're absolutely right. It does. Thank you.
So your photons are probing the relativistic part of the Bogoliubov response, so the linear part.
Yes.
Not the quadratic.
That's part. Right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So definitely then interactions are key.
I have no idea how to actually set it up in that regime. So please pardon my ignorance about that.
So then it is a squeezed. Well, it's interesting.
You give me the theory, and I say, oh, that's an effective vacuum. I'm going to take that at face value and see what I can do with it.
It's relativistic. You need that to get. But if you look at the two-particle point of view, it's squeezed. If you look at the original atoms, it's squeezed.
I think I may have misinterpreted your initial comment then. Sorry about that. Thanks for the clarification.
Okay, well, that was a great extended discussion. So I think we'll move on to our last talk of the morning. Francisco.
Okay.